said. We're not deciding right now. We'll need to quietly research the details internally. Something might leak, and you need to be ready to dance around questions.
How long have we got to make a decision? Teddy asked.
The window for starting the maneuver ends in 39 hours.
All right, Teddy said. Everyone, we discuss this only in person or on the phone, never email. And don't talk to anyone about this other than the people here. The last thing we need is public opinion pressing for a risky cowboy rescue that may be impossible.
Beck. Hey, man. How you been?
Now that I'm in a dire situation, I don't have to follow social rules anymore. I can be honest with everyone. Bearing that in mind, I have to say, dude, you need to tell Johansson how you feel. If you don't, you'll regret it forever. I won't lie. It could end badly. I have no idea what she thinks of you, or of anything. She's weird. But wait till the mission's over. You're on a ship with her for another 2 months. Also, if you guys got up to anything while the mission was in progress, Lewis would kill you.
Venkat, Mitch, Annie, Bruce, and Teddy met for the second time in as many days. Project Elrond had taken on a dark connotation throughout the Space Center, veiled in secrecy. Many people knew the name, none knew its purpose. Speculation ran rampant. Some thought it was a completely new program in the works. Others worried it might be a move to cancel Ares 4 and 5. Most thought it was Ares 6 in the works.
It wasn't an easy decision, Teddy said to the assembled elite. But I've decided to go with Iris 2. No Rich Purnell maneuver.
Mitch slammed his fist on the table.
We'll do all we can to make it work, Bruce said.
If it's not too much to ask, Venkat began. What made up your mind?
Teddy sighed.
It's a matter of risk, he said. Iris 2 only risks one life. Rich Purnell risks all 6 of them. I know Rich Purnell is more likely to work, but I don't think it's 6 times more likely.
You coward, Mitch said.
Mitch, Venkat said.
You goddamn coward, Mitch continued, ignoring Venkat. You just want to cut your losses. You're on damage control. You don't give a shit about Watney's life.
Of course I do, Teddy replied. And I'm sick of your infantile attitude. You can throw all the tantrums you want, but the rest of us have to be adults. This isn't a TV show. The riskier solution isn't always the best.
Space is dangerous, Mitch snapped. It's what we do here. If you want to play it safe all the time, go join an insurance company. And by the way, it's not even your life you're risking. The crew can make up their own minds about it.
No, they can't, Teddy fired back. They're too emotionally involved. Clearly, so are you. I'm not gambling 5 additional lives to save one, especially when we might save him without risking them at all.
Bullshit, Mitch shot back as he stood from his chair. You're just convincing yourself the crash lander will work so you don't have to take a risk. You're hanging him out to dry, you chicken shit son of a bitch.
He stormed out of the room, slamming the door behind him. After a few seconds, Venkat followed behind, saying,
I'll make sure he cools off.
Bruce slumped in his chair.
Sheesh, he said nervously. We're scientists, for Christ's sake. What the hell?
Annie quietly gathered her things and placed them in her briefcase. Teddy looked to her.
Sorry about that, Annie, he said.
What can I say? Sometimes men let testosterone take over.
I was hoping he'd kick your ass, she interrupted.
What?
I know you care about the astronauts, but he's right. You are a fucking coward. If you had balls, we might be able to save Watney.
Lewis.
Hi, Commander.
Between training and our trip to Mars, I spent 2 years working with you. I think I know you pretty well, so I'm guessing you still blame yourself for my situation despite my earlier email asking you not to. You were faced with an impossible scenario and made a tough decision. That's what commanders do. And your decision was right. If you'd waited any longer, the MAV would have tipped. I'm sure you've run through all the possible outcomes in your head, so you know there's nothing you could have done differently, other than be psychic. You probably think losing a crewman is the worst thing that can happen. Not true. Losing the whole crew is worse. You kept that from happening.
but there's something more important we need to discuss. What is it with you and Disco? I can understand the 70s TV, because everyone loves hairy people with huge collars, but Disco? Disco? Vogel checked the position and orientation of Hermes against the projected path. It matched, as usual. In addition to being the mission's chemist, he was also an accomplished astrophysicist, though his duties as navigator were laughably easy. The computer knew the course. It knew when to angle the ship so the ion engines would be aimed correctly, and it knew the location of the ship at all times, easily calculated from the position of the sun and earth, and knowing the exact time from an onboard atomic clock. Barring a complete computer failure or other critical event, Vogel's vast knowledge of astrodynamics would never come into play. After completing the check, he ran a diagnostic on the engines. They were functioning at peak. He did all this from his quarters. All onboard computers could control all ship's functions. Gone were the days of physically visiting the engines to check up on them. Having completed his work for the day, he finally had time to read email. Sorting through the messages NASA deemed worthy to upload, he read the most interesting first and responded when necessary. His responses were cached and would be sent to Earth with Johansson's next uplink. A message from his wife caught his attention, titled Unsere Kinder, Our Children. It contained nothing but an image attachment. He raised an eyebrow. Several things stood out at once. First, Kinder should have been capitalized. Helena, a grammar school teacher in Bremen, was very unlikely to make that mistake. Also, to each other, they affectionately called their kids Die Affen. When he tried to open the image, his viewer reported that the file was unreadable. He walked down the narrow hallway. The crew quarters stood against the outer hull of the constantly spinning ship to maximize simulated gravity. Johansson's door was open, as usual. Johansson, good evening, Vogel said. The crew kept the same sleep schedule, and it was nearing bedtime. Oh, hello, Johansson said, looking up from her computer.
I have the computer problem, Vogel explained. I wonder if you will help.
Sure, she said.
You are in the personal time, Vogel said. Perhaps tomorrow, when you are on the duty, is better.
Now's fine, she said. What's wrong?
It is a file. It is an image, but my computer cannot view.
Where's the file? She asked, typing on her keyboard.
It is on my shared space. The name is kinder.jpg.
Let's take a look, she said. Her fingers flew over her keyboard as windows opened and closed on her screen. Definitely a bad JPEG header, she said. Probably mangled in the download. Let me look with the hex editor, see if we got anything at all. After a few moments, she said, This isn't a JPEG, it's a plain ASCII text file. Looks like... Well, I don't know what it is. Looks like a bunch of math formulae. She gestured to the screen. Does any of this make sense to you? Vogel leaned in, looking at the text.
Yeah, he said. It is a course maneuver for Hermes. It says the name is Rich Purnell Maneuver.
What's that? Johansson asked.
I have not heard of this maneuver.
He looked at the tables.
It is complicated. Very complicated.
He froze.
Sol 549, he exclaimed.
Mein Gott! The Hermes crew enjoyed their scant personal time in an area called the Wreck. Consisting of a table and barely room to seat six, it ranked low in gravity priority. Its position amidships granted it a mere 0.2G. Still, it was enough to keep everyone in a seat as they pondered what Vogel told them.
And then, mission would conclude with Earth intercept 211 days later, he finished up.
Thank you, Vogel, Lewis said. She'd heard the explanation earlier when Vogel came to her, but Johansson, Martinez, and Beck were hearing it for the first time. She gave them a moment to digest.
Would this really work? Martinez asked.
Yeah, Vogel nodded. I ran the numbers. They all checked out. It is brilliant course. Amazing.
How would he get off Mars? Martinez asked.
Lewis leaned forward.
There was more in the message, she began. We'd have to pick up a supply near Earth, and he'd have to get to Ares IV's MAV.
Why all the cloak and dagger? Beck asked.
According to the message, Lewis explained, NASA rejected the idea. They'd rather take a big risk on Watney than a small risk on all of us. Whoever snuck it into Vogel's email obviously disagreed.
So, Martinez said, we're talking about going directly against NASA's decision?
Yes, Lewis confirmed. That's exactly what we're talking about. If we go through with the maneuver, they'll have to send the supply ship or we'll die. We have the opportunity to force their hand.
Are we going to do it? Johansson asked.
They all looked to Lewis. I won't lie, she said. I'd sure as hell like to, but this isn't a normal decision. This is something NASA expressly rejected. We're talking about mutiny, and that's not a word I throw around lightly. She stood and paced slowly around the table. We'll only do it if we all agree, and before you answer, consider the consequences. If we mess up the supply rendezvous, we die. If we mess up the Earth gravity assist, we die. If we do everything perfectly, we add 533 days to our mission. 533 days of unplanned space travel where anything could go wrong. Maintenance will be a hassle. Something might break that we can't fix. If it's life critical, we die.
Well, sign me up, Martinez smiled.
Easy, cowboy, Lewis said. You and I are military. There's a good chance we'd be court-martialed when we got home. As for the rest of you, I guarantee they'll never send you up again. Martinez leaned against the wall, arms folded with a half-grin on his face. The rest silently considered what their commander had said.
If we do this, Vogel said, it would be over 1,000 days of space. This is enough space for a life. I do not need to return.
Sounds like Vogel's in, Martinez grinned.
Me too, obviously.
Let's do it, Beck said.
If you think it'll work, Johansson said to Lewis.
I trust you.
Okay, Lewis said. If we go for it, what's involved?
Vogel shrugged.
I plot the course and execute it, he said.
What else?
Remote override, Johansson said. It's designed to get the ship back if we all die or something. They can take over Hermes from mission control.
But we're right here, Lewis said. We can undo whatever they try, right?
Not really, Johansson said. Remote override takes priority over any onboard controls. It assumes there's been a disaster and the ship's control panels can't be trusted.
Can you disable it? Lewis asked.
Johansson pondered.
Hermes has 4 redundant flight computers, each connected to 3 redundant comm systems. If any computer gets a signal from any comm system, mission control can take over. We can't shut down the comms. We lose telemetry and guidance. We can't shut down the computers. We need them to control the ship. I'll have to disable the remote override on each system. It's part of the OS. I'll have to jump over the code.
Yes, I can do it.
You're sure?
Lewis asked.
You can turn it off.
Shouldn't be hard, Johansson said. It's an emergency feature, not a security program. It isn't protected against malicious code.
Malicious code? Beck smiled. So, you'll be a hacker?
Yeah, Johansson smiled back. I guess I will.
All right, Lewis said. Looks like we can do it. But I don't want peer pressure forcing anyone into it. We'll wait for 24 hours. During that time, anyone can change their mind. Just talk to me in private or send me an email. I'll call it off and never tell anyone who it was. Lewis stayed behind as the rest filed out. Watching them leave, she saw they were smiling. All 4 of them. For the first time since leaving Mars, they were back to their old selves. She knew right then no one's mind would change. They were going back to Mars. Everyone knew Brendan Hutch would be running missions soon. He'd risen through NASA's ranks as fast as one could in the large, inertia-bound organization. He was known as a diligent worker, and his skill and leadership qualities were plain to all his subordinates. Brendan was in charge of mission control from 1 a.m. to 9 a.m. every night. Continued excellent performance in this role would certainly net him a promotion. It had already been announced he'd be backup flight controller for Ares IV, and he had a good shot at the top job for Ares V.
Flight, Capcom, a voice said through his headset.
Go, Capcom,
Brendan responded. Though they were in the same room, radio protocol was observed at all times.
Unscheduled status update from Hermes.
With Hermes 90 light seconds away, back-and-forth voice communication was impractical. Other than media relations, Hermes would communicate via text until they were much closer.
Roger, Brendan said. Read it out.
I don't get it, Flight, came the confused reply. No real status, just a single sentence.
What's it say?
Message reads, Houston, be advised. Rich Purnell is a steely-eyed missile man.
What? Brendan asked. Who the hell is Rich Purnell?
Flight, telemetry, another voice said.
Go, telemetry, Brendan said.
Hermes is off course.
Capcom, advise Hermes they're drifting. Telemetry, get a correction vector ready.
Negative, Flight, telemetry interrupted. It's not drift. They adjusted course. Instrumentation uplink shows a deliberate 27.812-degree rotation.
What the hell? Brendan stammered.
Capcom, ask them what the hell.
Roger, Flight. Message sent. Minimum reply time 3 minutes, 4 seconds.
Telemetry, any chance this is instrumentation failure?
Negative, Flight. We're tracking them with SATCON. Observed position is consistent with the course change.
Capcom, read your logs and see what the previous shift did. See if a massive course change was ordered and somehow nobody told us.
Roger, Flight.
Guidance, Flight, Brendan said.
Go, Flight, was the reply from the guidance controller.
Work out how long they can stay on this course before it's irreversible. At what point will they no longer be able to intercept Earth?
Working on that now, Flight.
And somebody find out who the hell Rich Purnell is?
Mitch plopped down on the couch in Teddy's office. He put his feet up on the coffee table and smiled at Teddy.
You wanted to see me?
Why'd you do it, Mitch? Teddy demanded.
Do what? You know damn well what I'm talking about.
Oh, you mean the Hermes Mutiny? Mitch said innocently.
You know, that'd make a good movie title. The Hermes Mutiny. Got a nice ring to it.
We know you did it, Teddy said sternly. We don't know how, but we know you sent them the maneuver.
So you don't have any proof?
Teddy glared.
No, not yet, but we're working on it.
Really? Mitch said.
Is that really the best use of our time? I mean, we have a near-Earth resupply to plan, not to mention figuring out how to get Watney to Schiaparelli. We've got a lot on our plates.
You're damn right we have a lot on our plates, Teddy fumed.
After your little stunt, we're committed to this thing.
Alleged stunt, Mitch said, raising a finger.
I suppose Annie will tell the media we decided to try this risky maneuver, and she'll leave out the mutiny part.
Of course, Teddy said. Otherwise, we'd look like idiots.
I guess everyone's off the hook, then, Mitch smiled. Can't fire people for enacting NASA policy. Even Lewis is fine.
What mutiny?
And maybe Watney gets to live. Happy endings all around.
You may have killed the whole crew, Teddy countered. Ever think of that?
Whoever gave them the maneuver, Mitch said, only passed along information.
Lewis made the decision to act on it.
If she let emotion cloud her judgment, she'd be a shitty commander. And she's not a shitty commander.
If I can ever prove it was you, I'll find a way to fire you for it, Teddy warned.
Sure, Mitch shrugged. But if I wasn't willing to take risks to save lives, I'd...
He thought for a moment.
Well, I guess I'd be you.
Chapter 17 Log Entry, Sol 192.
Holy shit. They're coming back for me. I don't even know how to react. I'm choked up. And I've got a shitload of work to do before I catch that bus home. They can't orbit. If I'm not in space, when they pass by, all they can do is wave. I have to get to Ares IV's MAV. Even NASA accepts that. And when the nannies at NASA recommend a 3,200-kilometer overland drive... You know you're in trouble. Schiaparelli, here I come. Well, not right away. I still have to do the aforementioned shitload of work. My trip to Pathfinder was a quick jaunt compared to the epic journey that's coming up.
I got away with a lot of shortcuts because I only had to survive 18 souls. This time, things are different. I averaged 80 kilometers per soul on my way to Pathfinder. If I do that well towards Schiaparelli, the trip will take 40 souls. Call it 50 to be safe. But there's more to it than just travel. Once I get there, I'll need to set up camp and do a bunch of MAV modifications. NASA estimates they'll take 30 souls, 45 to be safe. Between the trip and the MAV mods, that's 95 souls. Call it 100, because 95 cries out to be approximated. So I'll need to survive away from the HAB for 100 souls. What about the MAV, I hear you ask, in my fevered imagination. Won't it have some supplies, air and water at the very least? Nope, it's got dick all. It does have air tanks, but they're empty. An Ares mission needs lots of O2, N2, and water anyway. Why send more with the MAV? Easier to have the crew top off the MAV from the HAB. Fortunately for my crewmates, the mission plan had Martinez fill the MAV tanks on Sol 1. The flyby is on Sol 549, so I'll need to leave by 449. That gives me 257 souls to get my ass in gear. Seems like a long time, doesn't it? In that time, I need to modify the rover to carry the big three, the atmospheric regulator, the oxygenator, and the water reclaimer. All three need to be in the pressurized area, but the rover isn't big enough. All three need to be running at all times, but the rover's batteries can't handle that load for long. The rover will also need to carry all my food, water, and solar cells, my extra battery, my tools, some spare parts, and Pathfinder. As my sole means of communication with NASA, Pathfinder gets to ride on the roof, Granny Clampett style. I have a lot of problems to solve, but I have a lot of smart people to solve them. Pretty much the whole planet Earth. NASA is still working on the details, but the idea is to use both rovers. One to drive around, the other to act as my cargo trailer. I'll have to make structural changes to that trailer, and by structural changes I mean cut a big hole in the hull. Then I can move the big three in and use HAB canvas to loosely cover the hole. It'll balloon out when I pressurize the rover, but it'll hold. How will I cut a big chunk out of a rover's hull? I'll let my lovely assistant Venkat Kapoor explain further. 1400 hours, 38 minutes, JPL. I'm sure you're wondering how to cut a hole in the rover. Our experiments show a rock sample drill can get through the hull. Wear and tear on the bits is minimal. Rocks are harder than carbon composite. You can cut holes in a line, then chisel out the remaining chunks between them. I hope you like drilling. The drill bit is 1 centimeter wide. The holes will be 0.5 centimeters apart, and the length of the total cut is 11.4 meters. That's 760 holes, and each one takes 160 seconds to drill. Problem. The drills weren't designed for construction projects. They were intended for quick rock samples. The batteries only last 240 seconds. You do have two drills, but you'd still only get three holes done before needing to recharge, and recharging takes 41 minutes. That's 173 hours of work, limited to 8 EVA hours per day. That's 21 days of drilling, and that's just too long. All our other ideas hinge on this cut working. If it doesn't, we need time to come up with new ones. So we want you to wire a drill directly to HAB power. The drill expects 28.8 volts and pulls 9 amps. The only lines that can handle that are the rover recharge lines. They are 36 volts, 10 amp max. Since you have two, we're comfortable with you modifying one. We'll send you instructions on how to step down the voltage and put a new breaker in the line. But I'm sure you already know how. I'll be playing with high voltage power tomorrow. Can't imagine anything going wrong with that. Log entry. Sol 193. I managed to not kill myself today, even though I was working with high voltage. Well, it's not as exciting as all that. I disconnected the line first. As instructed, I turned a rover charging cable into a drill power source. Getting the voltage right was a simple matter of adding resistors, which my electronics kit has in abundance. I had to make my own 9-amp breaker. I strung three 3-amp breakers in parallel.
There's no way for 9 amps to get through that without tripping all 3 in rapid succession. Then I had to rewire a drill, pretty much the same thing I did with Pathfinder, take out the battery and replace it with a power line from the hab, but this time it was a lot easier. Pathfinder was too big to fit through any of my airlocks, so I had to do all the rewiring outside. Ever done electronics while wearing a spacesuit? Pain in the ass. I even had to make a workbench out of MAV landing struts, remember? Anyway, the drill fit in the airlock easily. It's only a meter tall and shaped like a jackhammer. We did our rock sampling standing up like Apollo astronauts. Also, unlike my Pathfinder hatchet job, I had the full schematics of the drill. I removed the battery and attached a power line where it used to be. Then, taking the drill and its new cord outside, I connected it to the modified rover charger and fired it up. Worked like a charm. The drill whirled away with happy abandon. Somehow I had managed to do everything right the first try. Deep down I thought I'd fry the drill for sure. It wasn't even midday yet. I figured, why not get a jump on drilling? 10 hundred hours, 7 minutes. Watney. Power line modifications complete. Hooked it up to a drill, and it works great. Plenty of daylight left. Send me a description of that hole you want me to cut. 10 hundred hours, 25 minutes. JPL. Glad to hear it. Starting on the cut sounds great. Just to be clear, these are modifications to Rover 1, which we've been calling the trailer. Rover 2, the one with your modifications for the trip to Pathfinder, should remain as is for now. You'll be taking a chunk out of the roof just in front of the airlock in the rear of the vehicle. The hole needs to be at least 2.5 meters long and the full 2 meters width of the pressure vessel. Before any cuts, draw the shape on the trailer and position the trailer where Pathfinder's camera can see it. We'll let you know if you got it right. 10 hundred hours, 43 minutes. Watney. Roger. Take a pic at 11:30, if you haven't heard from me by then. The rovers are made to interlock so one can tow the other. That way you can rescue your crewmates if all hell breaks loose. For that same reason, rovers can share air via hoses you connect between them. That little feature will let me share atmosphere with the trailer on my long drive. I'd stolen the trailer's battery long ago. It had no ability to move under its own power, so I hitched it up to my awesomely modified rover and towed it into place near Pathfinder. Venkat told me to draw the shape I planned to cut, but he neglected to mention how. It's not like I have a Sharpie that can work out on the surface. So I vandalized Martinez's bed. The cots are basically hammocks, lightweight string woven loosely into something that's comfortable to sleep on. Every gram counts when making stuff to send to Mars. I unraveled Martinez's bed and took the string outside, then taped it to the trailer hull along the path I planned to cut. Yes, of course, duct tape works in a near vacuum. Duct tape works anywhere. Duct tape is magic and should be worshipped. I can see what NASA has in mind. The rear of the trailer has an airlock that we're not going to mess with. The cut is just ahead of it and will leave plenty of space for the Big Three to stand. I have no idea how NASA plans to power the Big Three for 24 and a half hours a day and still have energy left to drive. I bet they don't know either. But they're smart. They'll work something out. 11 hundred hours, 49 minutes. JPL. What we can see of your planned cut looks good. We're assuming the other side is identical. You're cleared to start drilling. 1200 hours, 7 minutes. Watney. That's what she said. 1200 hours, 25 minutes. JPL. Seriously, Mark? Seriously? First, I depressurized the trailer. Call me crazy, but I didn't want the drill explosively launched at my face. Then I had to pick somewhere to start. I thought it'd be easiest to start on the side. I was wrong. The roof would have been better. The side was a hassle because I had to hold the drill parallel to the ground. This isn't your dad's Black and Decker we're talking about. It's a meter long and only safe to hold by the handles. Getting it to bite was nasty. I pressed it against the hull and turned it on, but it wandered all over the place. So I got my trusty hammer and screwdriver. With a few taps, I made a small chip in the carbon composite. That gave the bit a place to seat, so I could keep drilling in one place.
As NASA predicted, it took about 2.5 minutes to get all the way through. I followed the same procedure for the second hole, and it went much smoother. After the third hole, the drill's overheat light came on. The poor drill wasn't designed to operate constantly for so long. Fortunately, it sensed the overheat and warned me. So I leaned it against the workbench for a few minutes, and it cooled down. One thing you can say about Mars, it's really cold. The thin atmosphere doesn't conduct heat very well, but it cools everything eventually. I had already removed the drill's cowling. The power cord needed a way in. A pleasant side effect is the drill cools even faster, though I'll have to clean it thoroughly every few hours as dust accumulates. By 1700 hours, when the sun began to set, I had drilled 75 holes. A good start, but there's still tons to do. Eventually, probably tomorrow, I'll have to start drilling holes that I can't reach from the ground. For that, I'll need something to stand on. I can't use my workbench. It's got Pathfinder on it, and the last thing I'm going to do is mess with that. But I've got 3 more MAV landing struts. I'm sure I can make a ramp or something. Anyway, that's all stuff for tomorrow. Tonight is about eating a full ration for dinner. Oh yeah, that's right. I'm either getting rescued on Sol 549 or I'm dying. That means I have 35 sols of extra food. I can indulge once in a while. Log entry, Sol 194. I average a hole every 3.5 minutes. That includes the occasional breather to let the drill cool off. I learned this by spending all damn day drilling. After 8 hours of dull, physically intense work, I had 137 holes to show for it. It turned out to be easy to deal with places I couldn't reach. I didn't need to modify a landing strut after all. I just had to get something to stand on. I used a geological sample container, also known as a box. Before I was in contact with NASA, I would have worked more than 8 hours. I can stay out for 10 before even dipping into emergency air, but NASA's got a lot of nervous Nellies who don't want me out longer than spec. With today's work, I'm about 1/4 of the way through the whole cut. At least 1/4 of the way through the drilling. Then I'll have 759 little chunks to chisel out. And I'm not sure how well carbon composite is going to take to that. But NASA'll do it 1,000 times back on Earth and tell me the best way to get it done. Anyway, at this rate, it'll take 4 more sols of boring-ass work to finish the drilling. I've actually exhausted Lewis's supply of shitty 70s TV, and I've read all of Johansson's mystery books. I've already rifled through other crewmate stuff to find entertainment, but all of Vogel's stuff is in German. Beck brought nothing but medical journals, and Martinez didn't bring anything. I got really bored, so I decided to pick a theme song, something appropriate, and naturally it should be something from Lewis's god-awful 70s collection. It wouldn't be right any other way. There are plenty of candidates. Life on Mars by David Bowie, Rocket Man by Elton John, Alone Again, Naturally, by Gilbert O'Sullivan. But I settled on Stayin' Alive by the Bee Gees. Log entry, Sol 195. Another day, another bunch of holes. 145 this time. I'm getting better. I'm halfway done. This is getting really old. But at least I have encouraging messages from Venkat to cheer me on. 1700 hours, 12 minutes. Watney, 145 holes today, 357 total. 1700 hours, 31 minutes. JPL, we thought you'd have more done by now. Dick. Anyway, I'm still bored at night. I guess that's a good thing. Nothing's wrong with the hab. There's a plan to save me, and the physical labor is making me sleep wonderfully. I miss tending the potatoes. The hab isn't the same without them. There's still soil everywhere. No point in lugging it back outside. Lacking anything better to do, I ran some tests on it. Amazingly, some of the bacteria survived. The population is strong and growing. That's pretty impressive when you consider it was exposed to near vacuum and subarctic temperatures for over 24 hours. My guess is pockets of ice formed around some of the bacteria, leaving a bubble of survivable pressure inside, and the cold wasn't quite enough to kill them. With hundreds of millions of bacteria, it only takes one survivor to stave off extinction. Life is amazingly tenacious. They don't want to die any more than I do.
Log entry. Sol 196.
I fucked up. I fucked up big time. I made a mistake that might kill me. I started my EVA around 0800 hours, 45 minutes. I got my hammer and screwdriver and started chipping the trailer's hull. It's a pain in the ass to make a chip before each drilling, so I make all the day's chips in a single go. After chipping out 150 divots, hey, I'm an optimist, I got to work. It was the same as yesterday and the day before. Drill through, relocate, drill through, relocate, drill through a third time, then set the drill aside to cool. Repeat that process over and over till lunchtime. At 1200 hours, I took a break. Back in the hab, I enjoyed a nice lunch and played some chess against the computer. It kicked my ass. Then back out for the day's second EVA. At 1300 hours, 30 minutes, my ruination occurred, though I didn't realize it at the time. The worst moments in life are heralded by small observations. The tiny lump on your side that wasn't there before. Coming home to your wife and seeing two wine glasses in the sink. Anytime you hear, "We interrupt this program." For me, it was when the drill didn't start. Only 3 minutes earlier, it was working fine. I had finished a hole and set the drill aside to cool. Same as always. But when I tried to get back to work, it was dead. The power light wouldn't even come on. I wasn't worried. If all else failed, I had another drill. It would take a few hours to wire it up, but that's hardly a concern. The power light being off meant there was probably something wrong with the line. A quick glance at the airlock window showed the lights were on in the hab, so there were no systemic power problems. I checked my new breakers, and sure enough, all three had tripped. I guess the drill pulled a little too much amperage. No big deal. I reset the breakers and got back to work. The drill fired right up, and I was back to making holes. Doesn't seem like a big deal, right? I certainly didn't think so at the time. I finished my day at 1700 hours after drilling 131 holes. Not as good as yesterday, but I lost some time to the drill malfunction. I reported my progress. 1700 hours, 8 minutes. Watney. 131 holes today, 488 total. Minor drill issue. It tripped the breakers. There may be an intermittent short in the drill, probably in the attachment point of the power line. Might need to redo it. Earth and Mars are just over 18 light minutes apart now. Usually, NASA responds within 25 minutes. Remember, I do all my communication from Rover 2, which relays everything through Pathfinder. I can't just lounge in the hab awaiting a reply. I have to stay in the rover until they acknowledge the message. 1700 hours, 38 minutes. Watney. Have received no reply. Last message sent 30 minutes ago. Please acknowledge. I waited another 30 minutes. Still no reply. Fear started to take root. Back when JPL's Nerd Brigade hacked the rover and Pathfinder to be a poor man's IM client, they sent me a cheat sheet for troubleshooting. I executed the first instruction. 1800 hours, 9 minutes. Watney. System command. Status. 1800 hours, 9 minutes. System. Last message sent, 0000 hours, 31 minutes ago. Last message received, 2600 hours, 17 minutes ago. Last ping reply from probe received, 0400 hours, 24 minutes ago. Warning. 52 unanswered pings. Pathfinder was no longer talking to the rover. It had stopped answering pings 4 hours and 24 minutes ago. Some quick math told me that was around 1300 hours 30 minutes today. The same time the drill died. I tried not to panic. The troubleshooting sheet has a list of things to try if communication is lost. They are, in order. 1. Confirm power still flowing to Pathfinder. 2. Reboot rover. 3. Reboot Pathfinder by disconnecting then reconnecting power. 4. Install rover's comm software on the other rover's computer. Try from there. 5. If both rovers fail, problem is likely with Pathfinder. Check connections very closely. Clean Pathfinder of Martian dust. 6. Spell message in Morse code with rocks. Include things attempted. Problem may be recoverable with remote update of Pathfinder. I only got as far as step 1.
I checked Pathfinder's connections, and the negative lead was no longer attached. I was elated. What a relief! With a smile on my face, I fetched my electronics kit and prepared to reattach the lead. I pulled it out of the probe to give it a good cleaning, as best I could with the gloves of my spacesuit, and noticed something strange. The insulation had melted. I pondered this development. Melted insulation usually means a short. More current than the wire could handle had passed through. But the bare portion of the wire wasn't black or even singed, and the positive lead's insulation wasn't melted at all. Then, one by one, the horrible realities of Mars came into play. The wire wouldn't be burned or singed. That's a result of oxidization. And there's no oxygen in the air. There likely was a short after all. But with the positive lead being unaffected, the power must have come from somewhere else. And the drill's breaker tripped around the same time. Oh, shit. The internal electronics for Pathfinder included a ground lead to the hull. This way it could not build up a static charge in Martian weather conditions. No water and frequent sandblasting can make impressive static charge. The hull sat on panel A, one of four sides of the tetrahedron which brought Pathfinder to Mars. The other three sides are still in Ares Vallis where I left them. Between panel A and the workbench were the Mylar balloons Pathfinder had used to tumble land. I had shredded many of them to transport it, but a lot of material remained, enough to reach around panel A and be in contact with the hull. I should mention that Mylar is conductive. At 1300 hours 30 minutes, I leaned the drill against the workbench. The drill's cowling was off to make room for the power line. The workbench is metal. If the drill leaned against the workbench just right, it could make a metal-to-metal connection. And that's exactly what had happened. Power traveled from the drill line's positive lead, through the workbench, through the Mylar, through Pathfinder's hull, through a bunch of extremely sensitive and irreplaceable electronics, and out the negative lead of Pathfinder's power line. Pathfinder operates on 50 milliamps. It got 9,000 milliamps, which plowed through the delicate electronics, frying everything along the way. The breakers tripped, but it was too late. Pathfinder's dead. I've lost the ability to contact Earth. I'm on my own.
Chapter 18. Log Entry. Sol 197.
Sigh. Just once, I'd like something to go as planned, you know? Mars keeps trying to kill me. Well, Mars didn't electrocute Pathfinder, so I'll amend that. Mars and my stupidity keep trying to kill me. Okay, enough self-pity. I'm not doomed. Things will just be harder than planned. I have all I need to survive, and Hermes is still on the way. I spelled out a Morse code message using rocks. PF fried with 9 amps. Dead forever. Plan unchanged. We'll get to MAV. If I can get to the Ares 4 MAV, I'll be set. But having lost contact with NASA, I have to design my own Great Martian Winnebago to get there. For the time being, I've stopped all work on it. I don't want to continue without a plan. I'm sure NASA had all kinds of ideas, but now I have to come up with one on my own. As I mentioned, the big three, atmospheric regulator, oxygenator, and water reclaimer, are critical components. I worked around them for my trip to Pathfinder. I used CO2 filters to regulate the atmosphere and brought enough oxygen and water for the whole trip. That won't work this time. I need the big three. Problem is, they soak up a lot of power, and they have to run all day long. The rover batteries have 18 kilowatt-hours of juice. The oxygenator alone uses 44.1 kilowatt-hours per sol. See my problem? You know what? Kilowatt-hours per sol is a pain in the ass to say. I'm going to invent a new scientific unit name. 1 kilowatt-hour per sol is... It can be anything. I suck at this. I'll call it a pirate ninja. All told, the big three need 69.2 pirate ninjas, most of that going to the oxygenator and the atmospheric regulator. The water reclaimer only needs 3.6 of that. There'll be cutbacks. The easiest cutback is the water reclaimer. I have 620 liters of water. I had a lot more before the HAB blew up.
I need only 3 liters of water per soul, so my supply will last 206 souls. There's only 100 souls after I leave and before I'm picked up, or die in the attempt. Conclusion. I don't need the water reclaimer at all. I'll drink as needed and dump my waste outdoors. Yeah, that's right, Mars. I'm gonna piss and shit on you. That's what you get for trying to kill me all the time. There. I saved myself 3.6 pirate ninjas. Log entry. Sol 198. I've had a breakthrough with the oxygenator. I spent most of the day looking at the specs. It heats CO2 to 900 degrees Celsius, then passes it over a zirconio electrolysis cell to yank the carbon atoms off. Heating the gas is what takes most of the energy. Why is that important? Because I'm just one guy and the oxygenator was made for six. 1/6 the quantity of CO2 means 1/6 the energy to heat it. The spec says it draws 44.1 pirate ninjas, but all this time, it's only been using 7.35 because of the reduced load. Now we're getting somewhere. Then there's the matter of the atmospheric regulator. The regulator samples the air, figures out what's wrong with it, and corrects the problem. Too much CO2? Take it out. Not enough O2? Add some. Without it, the oxygenator is worthless. The CO2 needs to be separated in order to be processed. The regulator analyzes the air with spectroscopy, then separates the gases by supercooling them. Different elements turn to liquid at different temperatures. On Earth, supercooling this much air would take ridiculous amounts of energy. But, as I'm acutely aware, this isn't Earth. Here on Mars, supercooling is done by pumping air to a component outside the hab. The air quickly cools to the outdoor temperature, which ranges from negative 150 degrees Celsius to 0 degrees Celsius. When it's warm, additional refrigeration is used, but cold days can turn air to liquid for free. The real energy cost comes from heating it back up. If it came back to the hab unheated, I'd freeze to death. But wait, you're thinking, Mars's atmosphere isn't liquid. Why does the hab's air condense? The hab's atmosphere is over 100 times as dense, so it turns to liquid at much higher temperatures. The regulator gets the best of both worlds. Literally. Side note, Mars's atmosphere does condense at the poles. In fact, it solidifies into dry ice. Problem. The regulator takes 21.5 pirate ninjas. Even adding some of the hab's power cells would barely power the regulator for a soul, let alone give me enough juice to drive. More thinking is required. Log entry. Sol 199. I've got it. I know how to power the oxygenator and atmospheric regulator. The problem with small pressure vessels is CO2 toxicity. You can have all the oxygen in the world, but once the CO2 gets above 1%, you'll start to get drowsy. At 2%, it's like being drunk. At 5%, it's hard to stay conscious. 8% will eventually kill you. Staying alive isn't about oxygen, it's about getting rid of CO2. That means I need the regulator, but I don't need the oxygenator all the time. I just need to get CO2 out of the air and backfill with oxygen. I have 50 liters of liquid oxygen in 2 25-liter tanks here in the hab. That's 50,000 liters in gaseous form, enough to last 85 days. Not enough to see me through to rescue, but a hell of a lot. The regulator can separate the CO2 and store it in a tank, and it can add oxygen to my air from my oxygen tanks as needed. When I run low on oxygen, I can camp out for a day and use all my power to run the oxygenator and the stored CO2. That way, the oxygenator's power consumption doesn't eat up my driving juice. So I'll run the regulator all the time, but only run the oxygenator on days I dedicate to using it. Now, on to the next problem. After the regulator freezes the CO2 out, the oxygen and nitrogen are still gases, but they're negative 75 degrees Celsius. If the regulator fed that back to my air without reheating it, I'd be a popsicle within hours. Most of the regulator's power goes to heating the return air, so that doesn't happen. But I have a better way to heat it up, something NASA wouldn't consider on their most homicidal day. The RTG. Yes, the RTG. You may remember it from my exciting trip to Pathfinder, a lovely lump of plutonium so radioactive it gives off 1,500 watts of heat, which it uses to harvest 100 watts of electricity. So what happens to the other 1,400 watts? It gets radiated out as heat. On the trip to Pathfinder, I had to actually remove insulation from the rover to vent excess heat from the damn thing. I'll be tapping that back in place because I'll need that heat to warm up the return air from the regulator. I ran the numbers. The regulator uses 790 watts to constantly reheat air. The RTG's 1,400 watts is more than equal to the task, as well as keeping the rover a reasonable temperature. To test, I shut down the heaters and the regulator and noted its power consumption. After a few minutes, I turned them right back on again. Jesus Christ, that return air was cold. But I got the data I wanted. With heating, the regulator needs 21.5 pirate ninjas. Without it, drumroll, 1 pirate ninja. That's right. Almost all of the power was going to heat. As with most of life's problems, this one can be solved by a box of pure radiation. I spent the rest of the day double-checking my numbers and running more tests. It all checks out. I can do this. Log entry. Sol 200. I hauled rocks today. I needed to know what kind of power efficiency the rover/trailer will get. On the way to Pathfinder, I got 80 kilometers from 18 kilowatt hours. This time, the load will be a lot heavier. I'll be towing the trailer and all the other shit. I backed the rover up to the trailer and attached the tow clamps. Easy enough. The trailer had been depressurized for some time now. There's a couple of hundred little holes in it, after all. So I opened both airlock doors to have a straight shot at the interior. Then I threw a bunch of rocks in. I had to guess at the weight. The heaviest thing I'll bring with me is the water, 620 kilograms worth. My freeze-dried potatoes will add another 200 kilograms. I'll probably have more solar cells than before, and maybe a battery from the HAB, plus the atmospheric regulator and oxygenator, of course. Rather than weigh all that shit, I took a guess and called it 1,200 kilograms. Half a cubic meter of basalt weighs about that much, more or less. After 2 hours of brutal labor, during which I whined a lot, I got it all loaded in. Then, with both batteries fully charged, I drove circles around the HAB until I drained them both. With a blistering top speed of 25 kilometers per hour, it's not an action-packed thrill ride, but I was impressed it could maintain that speed with all the extra weight. The rover has spectacular torque. But physical law is a pushy little shit, and it exacted revenge for the additional weight. I only got 57 kilometers before I was out of juice. That was 57 kilometers on level ground, without having to power the regulator, which won't take much with the heater off. Call it 50 kilometers per day to be safe. At that rate, it would take 64 days to get to Schiaparelli. But that's just the travel time. Every now and then, I'll need to break for a day and let the oxygenator use all the power. How often? After a bunch of math, I worked out that my 18 Pirate Ninja budget can power the oxygenator enough to make about 2.5 sols of O2. I'd have to stop every 2 to 3 sols to reclaim oxygen. My 64 sol trip would become 92. That's too long. I'll tear my own head off if I have to live in the rover that long. Anyway, I'm exhausted from lifting rocks and whining about lifting rocks. I think I pulled something in my back. Gonna take it easy the rest of today. Log entry. Sol 201. Yeah, I definitely pulled something in my back. I woke up in agony. So I took a break from rover planning. Instead, I spent the day taking drugs and playing with radiation. First, I loaded up on Vicodin for my back. Hooray for Beck's medical supplies. Then I drove out to the RTG. It was right where I left it, in a hole, 4 kilometers away. Only an idiot would keep that thing near the HAB. So anyway, I brought it back to the HAB. Either it'll kill me, or it won't. A lot of work went into making sure it doesn't break. If I can't trust NASA, who can I trust? For now, I'll forget that NASA told us to bury it far away. I stored it on the roof of the rover for the trip back. That puppy really spews heat. I have some flexible plastic tubing intended for minor water reclaimer repairs. After bringing the RTG into the HAB, I very carefully glued some tubing around the heat baffles. Using a funnel made from a piece of paper, I ran water through the tubing, letting it drain into a sample container. Sure enough, the water heated up. That's not really a surprise, but it's nice to see thermodynamics being well-behaved. There's one tricky bit. The atmospheric regulator doesn't run constantly. The freeze separation speed is driven by the weather outside, so the returning frigid air doesn't come as a steady flow. And the RTG generates a constant, predictable heat. It can't ramp up its output. So I'll heat water with the RTG to create a heat reservoir, then I'll make the return air bubble through it. That way I don't have to worry about when the air comes in, and I won't have to deal with sudden temperature changes in the rover. When the Vicodin wore off, my back hurt even more than before. I'm going to need to take it easy. I can't just pop pills forever. So I'm taking a few days off from heavy labor. To that end, I made a little invention just for me. I took Johansson's cot and cut out the hammock. Then I draped spare hab canvas over the frame, making a pit inside the cot with extra canvas around the edges. Once I weighed down the excess canvas with rocks, I had a watertight bathtub. It only took 100 liters to fill the shallow tub. Then I stole the pump from the water reclaimer. I can go quite a while without the water reclaimer operating. I hooked it up to my RTG water heater and put both the input and output lines into the tub. Yes, I know this is ridiculous, but I hadn't had a bath since Earth, and my back hurts. Besides, I'm going to spend 100 sols with the RTG anyway. A few more won't hurt. That's my bullshit rationalization, and I'm sticking with it. It took 2 hours to heat the water to 37 degrees Celsius. Once it did, I shut off the pump and got in. Oh, man, all I can say is, ah, why the hell didn't I think of this before? Log entry, Sol 207. I spent the last week recovering from back problems. The pain wasn't bad, but there aren't any chiropractors on Mars, so I wasn't taking chances. I took hot baths twice a day, lay in my bunk a lot, and watched shitty 70s TV. I've already seen Lewis's entire collection, but I didn't have much else to do. I was reduced to watching reruns. I got a lot of thinking done. I can make everything better by having more solar panels. The 14 panels I took to Pathfinder provided the 18 kilowatt hours that the batteries could store. When traveling, I stowed the panels on the roof. The trailer gives me room to store another 7. Half of its roof will be missing because of the hole I'm cutting in it. This trip's power needs will be driven by the oxygenator. It all comes down to how much power I can give that greedy little bastard in a single soul. I want to minimize how often I have days with no travel. The more juice I can give the oxygenator, the more oxygen it'll liberate, and the longer I can go between those air souls. Let's get greedy. Let's say I can find a home for 14 more panels instead of 7. Not sure how to do that, but let's say I can. That would give me 36 pirate ninjas to work with, which would net me 5 souls of oxygen per air soul. I'd only have to stop once per 5 souls. That's much more reasonable. Plus, if I can arrange battery storage for the extra power, I could drive 100 kilometers per soul. Easier said than done, though. That extra 18 kilowatt hours of storage will be tough. I'll have to take 2 of the HAB's 9 kilowatt hour fuel cells and load them onto the rover or trailer. They aren't like the rover's batteries. They're not small or portable. They're light enough, but they're pretty big. I may have to attach them to the outside hull, and that would eat into my solar cell storage. 100 kilometers per soul is pretty optimistic, but let's say I could make 90 kilometers per soul, stopping every 5th soul to reclaim oxygen. I'd get there in 45 souls. That would be sweet. In other news, it occurred to me that NASA is probably shitting bricks. They're watching me with satellites and haven't seen me come out of the HAB for 6 days. With my back better, it was time to drop them a line. I headed out for an EVA. This time, being careful while lugging rocks around, I spelled out a Morse code message. Injured back. Better now. Continuing rover mods. That was enough physical labor for today. I don't want to overdo it. Think I'll have a bath. Log entry. Sol 208. Today it was time to experiment with the panels. First, I put the HAB on low power mode. No internal lights, all non-essential systems offline, all internal heating suspended. I'd be outside most of the day anyway. Then I detached 28 panels from the solar farm and dragged them to the rover. I spent 4 hours stacking them this way and that. The poor rover looked like the Beverly Hillbillies truck. Nothing I did worked. The only way to get all 28 on the roof was to make stacks so high they'd fall off the first time I turned. If I lashed them together, they'd fall off as a unit. If I found a